We now present the Bible for Today of the Air, read each week at the same time and over the same station, sponsored by the Bible for Today Incorporated and the Dean Burgon Society with International Studios at 900 Park Avenue, Collingswood, New Jersey. This is Dr. D.A. Waite, Director of the Bible for Today, speaking. And welcome to Daily Broadcast, Weekly Broadcast, rather, number 849 weeks of weekly broadcasting, standing together with the Dean Burgon Society in defense of traditional Bible texts, including the traditional Masoretic Hebrew Old Testament text, the traditional received Greek New Testament text, and the traditional English text, the King James Bible. We're building Bible confidence. Confidence in the King James Bible, because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. The order phone number is 1-800-JOHN-10-9. For other things, please call us on a question and answer phone, 856-854-4452, or email bft@biblefortoday.org. We'd like to hear from you. We'd like you to get our book called Defending the King James Bible. Now in its 8th printing, 350 pages, hardback edition. When I'd ask your bookstore to get Defending the King James Bible, or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Then have you ordered your Defined King James Bible, published in the Bible for Today? Uncommon words in the King James are defined accurately in the footnotes. It's deluxe, general leather, choice of 12-point large print, rather, 10-point medium print. Over 46,000 are in print and distributed worldwide. Why not order yourself a copy and one for your friends? The Defined King James Bible. Well, this week we're still talking about this guide to the textual criticism of the New Testament by Edward Miller, Associate of Dean John William Burgon. 150 pages, hardback edition, beautiful color, yellow and cover, rather, yellow and red, published by the Bible for Today's Auxiliary, actually published by the Dean Burgon Society, and we have it here at our Bible for Today ministry. We have it through the Dean Burgon Society. Wonderful publication. Came out originally about 1886, 85, and now it's still pertinent. Still pertinent. We still have a battle of so-called textual criticism. We're talking now about extreme textualism, talking about an answer to the theory and practice of Westcott and Hort. Edward Miller lived at the same time as Westcott and Hort, lived at the same time as Dean John William Burgon, and he fought them tooth and toenail. Let's continue, and here we're on page number 49. We hope you get a copy of this 150-page book. Let us know how to address you, and we'll tell you how to get your copy of the Guide to Textual Criticism of the New Testament. Miller says, incidental proofs, talking about incidental proofs, are not wanting that the character of disputed passages and of manuscripts came under careful discussion during this and the succeeding ages. He's talking about Dr. Hort's feeling that there are 12 neutral manuscripts of all the Gospels, and that's all he has, and he says they've come under scrutiny. It continues. It is inconceivable that amidst the wealth of dissident documents, that is, documents that are at variance with one another, dissident documents, and at a time when the literary intellect of the world was occupied with ecclesiastical questions, and the monuments of past authorship were being stored, that there could have existed such neglect of the purity of the sacred writings of the church, as is taken for granted by Dr. Hort. End of quote. Let me pause right here. Dr. Hort thought that the church neglected the purity of the sacred writings, and therefore his blunderous, horrible, monstrous B and Aleph texts, he thought, were the purest. And the churches didn't know what they were talking about when they laid those verses, those particular versions and manuscripts aside in favor of the traditional type of text, the Textus Receptus type of text that underlies our King James Bible. And we continue, Miller says, the abundance of contemporary commentaries forbids such a supposition. And of course, let me just pause right there. In other words, the world of the early church was occupied with ecclesiastical questions, and there were monuments of past authorship that were being stored. How could there be existed a neglect of the purity of the sacred writings of the church? And continue. Miller says, therefore, the Vatican and Sinaitic manuscripts cannot but receive very serious discredit from their want of following. What does that mean? The Vatican and Sinai manuscripts, that's manuscripts B and Aleph, those are the manuscripts on which the new versions are based, the manuscripts on which the New International Version is based, on which the Today's New International Version is based, the New American Standard Version, all of these different versions of today, the Holman Bible that's been coming out recently, that's come out recently, Rodman Holman Version, based on these false manuscripts, the English Standard Version, based on these manuscripts, all these different new revision of the New American Standard, based on these manuscripts, the New English Version, all these other things, the Living Version, these are based upon the false Vatican and Sinaitic manuscripts. It says, therefore, those manuscripts cannot but receive very serious discredit from their want of following. In other words, their lack of following. Dr. Jack Mormon has introduced in his work, 100 pages in all, some 356 doctrinal errors, passages where these manuscripts, Vatican and Sinai, are in doctrinal error. 356. He's also tabulated the favorability or the lack of it of B and Aleph, the Vatican and Sinai. Now, the Vatican Sinai manuscripts, Westcott and Hort Greek text. Today, we call that the United Bible Society text, such as used at Bob Jones University, Detroit Baptist Seminary, Calvary Baptist Seminary, and the Central Baptist Seminary. Could be called also the Nestle Island text, could be called the critical text. It's basically a text of Vatican Manuscript B and the Sinai Manuscript Aleph. These are the manuscripts that form the bedrock of this. These two manuscripts were polluted by the Gnostics of Egypt in the 1st and 2nd and 3rd centuries. They have all the earmarks of heresy on them. Now, how can a fundamentalist, Bible-believing Christian produce and propose and back up and stand upon and actually go forward with B and Aleph, which contain, both of which contain, so much false doctrine and theology? Now, if you doubt this, my friend, if you're listening to the broadcast and you doubt that doctrine is involved, you should take a look at Dr. Jack Mormon's 100-page book called The 356 Doctrinal Deviations and Manuscript Errors, Doctrinal Pastors of the NIV and Other Modern Versions. If you want to take a look at a briefer picture than 356, get a copy of my book, maybe you have it, called Defending the King James Bible. Chapter 5 defends the King James Bible in its theological superiority. And in that chapter 5 of my book, I list 158 doctrinal passages where B and Aleph are false, giving false doctrine, where the Textus Receptus that underlies our King James Bible gives true doctrine. And this traditional text gives true doctrine, not false doctrine. But notice also, Miller says, Vatican Sinai manuscripts cannot but receive very serious discredit from their want of following. Dr. Jack Mormon also, in his book Forever Settled, which we have reproduced in hardback edition, you ought to get a copy, Forever Settled, Dr. Jack Mormon has tabulated that the B and Aleph manuscripts and 43 others are the Westcott and Hort type of false B and Aleph manuscripts, and that's all we have that have been safeguarded down through the centuries that we have today. 45 manuscripts, B and Aleph and 43 others. Dr. Mormon has also tabulated that the remaining manuscripts of the 5,255, as of 1967 at least, there have been a few more found since then, but the basic percentages, I'm sure, are the same. In 1967, we found 5,210 manuscripts, on the other hand, that were basically Textus Receptus, traditional text manuscripts, and the lack of following B and Aleph and the 43 others, 45, well, that's less than 1% of the evidence. Now, what does that show to you, my friend? If only 45 manuscripts, B and Aleph and 45, 43 others, have been preserved and kept by the churches down through the centuries, whereas over 99% of the evidence, 5,210 plus, have the earmarks of the traditional text, the Textus Receptus type of text that underlies our King James Bible. What does that tell you about the following, the groups that followed B and Aleph and reproduced their heresies and their falsenesses versus the groups that multiplied the traditional text, the Textus Receptus that underlies the King James Bible? Why, it should talk clearly, my friend, that the churches knew what their Bible was and what the Bible wasn't. And they did not continue to reproduce manuscript after manuscript that they knew to be false. That's why Edward Miller, here on this page, page 49, at the very bottom of the page, says, therefore, there's a conclusion here, therefore, the Vatican and Sinaitic manuscripts, that's B and Aleph, cannot but receive very serious discredit from their want of following. The churches discarded them. The churches didn't even reproduce them and copy them. There's no continuity. They stop dead in their tracks at the 4th or 5th or 6th century, and they stop. Not so with the traditional text. Not so with the Textus Receptus that underlies our King James Bible. Text from the apostolic time right down to the present time, and churches have multiplied and multiplied and multiplied those manuscripts because of the tremendous truth involved in them. Let me continue. We're on page 50 now. And again, the theory of families or groups of manuscripts cannot stand in any definite or clearly cut shape. Let me pause right there. Westcott and Hort devised these families. We do not believe. Dean Burgot did not believe. Edward Miller did not believe. Frederick Scrivener did not believe in so-called families of manuscripts. You see, the Westcott and Hort text has so few manuscripts to go along with it that they must marshal every single artifice, every single disguise, every single mirage that is in their retinue, that is in their armament, and in their weapons of warfare to deceive the people today. And so one of their weapons, one of the chief weapons, is this idea of families. If you only have 45 or so manuscripts, and you've got to show that the 5,210 are no good, and that yours, which is less than 1% of the evidence God has preserved for us, is correct, you have to do some pretty tall figuring and thinking and making up some tales that are tall tales indeed. Falsification of evidence. That's exactly what Bishop Westcott and Professor Hort did, and when they brought forth the 1881 Greek text and the English Revised Version that was based upon it. They said, well, we just have 45. Let me see. Let's make up four different families, and let's have them fight against each other, and let's say that if you can get three families to agree on something and one disagrees, then you have three against one. And therefore, the families that have the three will be the winners. And so they divided up their measly 45 manuscripts. Approximate manuscripts, all they have, B and Aleph and 43 others. So they divided those three up, and a few of them were in this manuscript family, a few of them in this manuscript family, a few of them in this one. Whether you call them the Alexandrian family, the Caesarean family, or the Western family, whatever you call them, they lined up and ganged up against the other huge, monstrous, gigantic family known as the traditional text. They call it the Syrian text. They call it what they want, but we call it the Textus Receptus, received text, traditional text. Huge, humongous family, over 5,210 members in that family. And since they claim that there's a familial relationship, since there's a source that one is the ancestor and they just copies all the way down through the centuries, then the three families that have different words are better evidence than the one family with thousands upon thousands of manuscripts, which are evidence. So we do not believe in families at all. Miller says again, the theory of families or groups of manuscripts cannot stand in any definite, clearly cut shape. Since it was first proposed by Bentley, it has passed through constant modifications. The foundations laid by one master have been disturbed by his successor, whose own excavations and masses of cement have been remade by the next. The difficulties to which the constructors of an inexorable theory have been driven, the difficulties that they've been driven are shown by the severing of one manuscript after the example of Solomon's award into portions supposed to belong to three families. And of course, here they do, they take these different manuscripts and say, oh, this is this family, oh my, look, this is this family, this is another family. It's the manuscript family type of a genealogy. That's what was done in the Graf Wellhausen theory of the documentary hypothesis of the Old Testament, which we believe is absolutely false. And so here they've got the documentary hypothesis, and you slice them up. Here's this manuscript, this is a family. Who says it's a family? There's no evidence for families at all. Continuing, Dr. Scribner is surely right in describing the process as, quote, that violent and most unlikely hypothesis that Codex A follows the Byzantine class of authorities in the Gospels, the Western in the Acts and Catholic epistles, and the Alexandrian in St. Paul, end of quote. And that's, of course, what you have to have. If you have these families, you have to divide all of the different manuscripts into different families. And he's saying here, it's ridiculous to assume that Codex A, the Alexandrinus, would have three different families in the same manuscript, in the same document. It's preposterous. Let me continue. But it may be asked, is there then no truth at all in the assignment of characters to manuscripts, or in any sort of grouping? And the answer of a candid inquirer must be that there may perhaps be an amount of justice in the connotation of characteristic features, but that great care must be taken not to lay too much stress upon it, and certainly not to draw a few broad and dark lines separating one province from another. Miller goes on and says, and especially generalizations constructed upon such induction as the case admits must be employed most sparingly in deductive arguments, or logic will stand aghast. No, my friends, Edward Miller does not go along with families any more than I do, or Dean Burgon did, or Dr. Frederick Scribner did. And Miller goes on. And as to the families or groups suggested by Dr. Westcott and Hort, there are no doubt a number of documents which ordinarily support the traditional text. There are also others which make for what they call the neutral text, and others which support Western readings. And there are many that take different sides, and most of those which are generally found on one occasionally appear on the other. There are also Western readings and Alexandrian readings, but the existence of an Alexandrian text as distinct from their neutral text, the neutral text of Westcott and Hort, is more than doubtful. Dr. Hort's description of it is of the vaguest, and the materials of proof which are all that he can point to are of the scantiest. So here we have two words, vaguest and scantiest. Not much evidence to support that theory. Let me continue. Miller says, on page 51, now we now come to the position resting upon the supposed posteriority of the so-called Syrian text. Now that Syrian text is their jargon for the Textus Receptus, the traditional text, the text that underlies our King James Bible. So here's the position resting upon the supposed posteriority. Not anteriority, not earliness, but posterior, laterness of the so-called Syrian text. Now this is false. It's not later. It's not posterior. It is anterior. The so-called Syrian text, which is the received text, the text of Josephus, the traditional text, is anterior, not posterior. It's before the other perversions of B and Aleph, not after them. We continue. Here again, we are in the region of pure speculation, unsustained by historical facts. End of quote. Let me pause right here. Do you want a basis of your New Testament, or Old Testament for that matter, as a basis of pure speculation? Is that the kind of material that you want to put your eternal soul in the hands of? I do not want that kind of speculation. Pure speculation is guesswork. He says, unsustained by historical facts. Now, that's exactly what Westcott and Hoare did. They were thinking thoughts and hypotheses without the buttressing of facts to back the hypotheses up. And I don't want to follow such practices. Do you? Let me continue. Miller says, Dr. Hoare imagines, first, that there was a recension of the early Syrian version. The early Syrian version, which this school maintains was represented by the Curiatonian version, somewhere between AD 250 and 350 at Edessa or Nisibis or Antioch. Let me pause right there. The first pure speculative idea, one among many, of course, is by Hoare, Dr. Hoare, that there was a recension. That means a revision. That means a special edition. A recension of the early Syrian version. And this particular school of thought, Westcott and Hoare, and our present fundamentalists that go along with this nonsense, if I may call it that, believe that the earliest version was the Curiatonian version. But that's not right. We believe the earliest Syrian version was the Syrian Peshitta. But Dr. Hoare imagines that there was a recension of the early Syrian version, which this school maintains was represented by the Curiatonian version, somewhere between AD 250 and AD 350 at Edessa, Nisibis, or Antioch. Now, this recension theory is necessitated by the fact they had to explain why there was such similarity between the manuscripts that underlie our King James Bible, the so-called traditional text manuscripts. They had to explain it. And the only way that Westcott and Hoare could come up with it was this big lie, this big fanciful type of argument that said, well, let me see. We've got to show how they were so similar. And so let's say there was a revision of the Syrian version, or the Greek version, whatever that may be. They have the wrong original. It's the Peshitta, it's not the Curiatonian version of the Syriac. But they say, well, let's say there's a big revision, big recension, 250 AD and 350 AD at Edessa. And that's when they brought just one version out. They threw away all the Westcott and Hoare texts. And they basically came up with the Textus Receptus type of text in this recension. And that's how, and that's why they're so similar. The manuscripts that back the King James Bible are so similar because they had the recension. They threw out all the Westcott and Hoare B and Aleph type of readings and included only their own. That's why they're so similar. No, my friend, that's not why they're so similar. The manuscripts that go along with the traditional text are similar because the writers, the ones that copied them, the copyists, knew these to be the words of God and were very strict when they copied them, and very strict when they told others to copy them as well. And so there's no such thing as a recension or an early edition. Let me continue. Miller says, the result of this recension is said to have been the Peshitta version, which has hitherto been referred to in the second century. Let me pause right there. Westcott and Hoare said that the revision or recension of the Syrian version, the wrong one, by the way, they said it was the early one was the Curiatonian version in 250 or 350 AD. He said the result of that was the Peshitta. Absolutely not. First of all, there's no recension. Secondly, it couldn't be the Peshitta. The Peshitta was first, and the Keratonian version was next, after it. And he says that then he referred to the Peshitta version in the 2nd century, and that's what I refer to it as, about 150 A.D., 2nd century manuscript. Let me continue. Miller says, we may remark, by the way, that the Peshitta must be got rid of by extreme textualists, or it would witness inconveniently before the 4th century to the Syrian text. Now, get that point very clearly, my friend. The reason that Dr. Custer from Bob Judge University and other people who have studied this matter, the reason that they insist that the original Syrian version had to be the Keratonian Syriac, not the Peshitta. They had to do it. As he says, the extreme textualists had to put the Peshitta last, otherwise it would bear witness inconveniently before the 4th century to the Syrian text, which is the text that's a traditional text they talk about as being the Syrian text. Let me continue. Well, indeed, may Dr. Hort add, quote, even for conjecture, the materials are scanty, end of quote. Even for conjecture. Let me continue. It would have been truer to the facts, Triff said, quote, for such a conjecture, there are no materials at all, and therefore it must be abandoned, end of quote. That's what the conjecture should have been. They should have abandoned this nonsense, but they didn't. Let me continue. But Drs. Westcott and Hort also maintain that an authoritative recension of a much larger character was made after that of Antioch and resulted in the formation of the Syrian text of the Gospels in Greek, which was formed upon the Vulgate or Common Syriac version. Now that's what Hort is saying. That's what Westcott is saying. Miller asks the question, what proof exists anywhere of such a common Syriac version? What proof exists anywhere of such an important proceeding that we had a recension? A recension, be it observed, so thorough and so sweeping in its effects that according to the theory under consideration, it must have placed the text that produced in such a commanding situation that has reigned for 15 centuries without a rival. How could this have occurred without an achievement so great and famous that the report of it must have gone abroad? End of quote. What he's saying is, Westcott notes that there's a revision, a recension, and this proceeding has no record of it in history, though. There's no record of it in history. If it really took place, they would have had it there. Well, time's up for now. Remember the words of our Lord Jesus Christ in John 10:9. He said, I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he should be saved, and shall go in and out and find pasture. Write us. Bible for Today, Collinswood, New Jersey. Call us on the order line, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Ask your bookstore for Defending the King James Bible and the Defiant King James Bible, or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Dr. D.A. Waite, signing off and reminding you, you can have confidence in the King James Bible because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. We'll see you next broadcast, same time, same station. And we want you to tune in on the email. We're going to continue this extreme textualism analysis, the theories of Westcott and Hort that are still with us today. And they're wrong theories. We hope you'll ask a friend to tune in and tune in again next week at the same time. We stand for the Greek text that underlies our King James Bible. We stand for the Hebrew text that underlies our King James Bible. And we stand for the King James Bible itself. And we want you to stand for it as well. So write us for these matters if you're interested. Get the guide to subversive, not subversive, guide to textual criticism of the New Testament. Until next time, same station. Until then, so long. We now present the Bible for the Day of the Air. Read each week at the same time and over the same station. Sponsored by the Bible for Today Incorporated and the Dean Burgot Society, with international studios at 900 Park Avenue, Collingswood, New Jersey. This is Dr. D.A. Waite, Director of the Bible for Today, speaking. Welcome to weekly broadcast number 850. 850 weeks of weekly broadcasting, standing together with the Dean Burgon Society in defense of traditional Bible texts, including the traditional Masoretic Hebrew Old Testament text, the traditional received Greek New Testament text, and the King James Bible, the traditional English text, which is the King James Bible. We're building Bible confidence. Confidence in the King James Bible, because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. The order phone number is 1-800-JOHN-10-9. For other things, please call us on a question and answer phone, 856-854-4452, or email bft@bibleforthetoday.org. We'd like to hear from you. We'd like you to get our book called Defending the King James Bible. Now in its 8th printing, 350 pages, hardback edition. Why not ask your bookstore to get Defending the King James Bible, or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Then, have you ordered your defined King James Bible, published for the Bible for Today? Uncommon words of the King James are defined accurately in the footnotes. It's deluxe. Genuine leather, not another Bible in the world like it. Either a 12-point large print, 10-point medium print, 46,000 are in print and distributed worldwide. Why not order for yourself a copy and one or two or three for your friends? We're continuing in this week's broadcast talking about the Guide to Textual Criticism of the New Testament. It's by Edward Miller, Associate of Dean John William Burgon. It's a lovely, hardback, 150-page book published by the Dean Burgon Society. You ought to get a copy. Beautiful cover, yellow and red, as it is. We're in the Extreme Textualism chapter, refuting the theory of Westcott and Hort, what they believe. On page 52, hope that you'll get a copy of this book for yourself. Miller says, surely this must have been another Council of Nicaea, or at least a Council of Arimian. Such results could not have issued from a mystery like that of the viewless wind. Yet, there's possibly no record in the history. And to speak of a Council of the Church, but of any single incident justifying the assumption that such an authoritative vision ever took place. End of quote. So what he's saying is, there's no note in history that such a revision of the Greek New Testament or the Syrian Testament, whatever it was, there's no record in history that this meeting ever took place. It's an important point. Then Miller continues, never surely was there such an attempt before made to foist such a pure fiction upon history. Let me pause right there, end of quote. To foist and to force pure fiction on history. Terrible indeed. Fiction, fictitious things, things that are not true. And that's what happens when you have all these theories. You have all these theories and all these people with different theories, just trying to make an impression on somebody at least. Let me continue. But besides that, the arguments for the formation of a new text in the 4th century thoroughly break down. All right, now here's some of the arguments. Number one. The evidence is only the 8 instances given, and certainly not enough to establish the existence of such a conflation or a combination of supposed other texts into one eclectic reading throughout the New Testament. Now, we're going to get into eclecticism. That means picking from all certain points in order to bring them up at any time that you wish. That's eclecticism. I realize some classify that as conservative eclectics and liberal eclectics. But eclecticism means to call out from other sources and put them into one. And so this is pure fiction. Now, notice, he says, but supposing for a moment that these 8, and as he says, there are only 8 examples of conflation, which means to blow up or to enlarge. In other words, you take a phrase that A has and a phrase that B has, you put them together, and get A, B. That's called conflation. That's called building up. That's called adding A plus B equals AB. That's what Westcott and Hort had to show to support their theory that the B, an Aleph text was first, and that the Textus Receptus was after it. They had to say that the Textus Receptus is the sum of A plus B equals AB, to show that the AB was last and the A and B was first and preceded it. So they needed this so-called conflation, but there are only 8 examples of it. The Westcott and Hort said if there's our position is if they had really a number of examples, could they not have trotted on more than 8? Beside that, the arguments, he says, for the formation of a new text in the 4th century thoroughly break down. Now, as he says, the evidence has only 8 examples of this so-called completion. Miller goes on, but supposing for a moment that these 8 were specimens of what constantly occurs, who from internal evidence alone can say dogmatically which is posterior, the entire text, or the respective portions of it? End of quote. Let's just pause right there and say, what is he saying here? He says, how can you prove that the longer reading was second and the 2 shorter readings were first? There's no way to prove that. You see, if I say steak and potatoes, it's 2 separate documents. One has steak, one has potatoes. And then I come along and say steak and potatoes, put the 2 together. Who is to say that the steak plus potatoes is first and the steak and potatoes together is second? Who is to say? In fact, far easier is it to assume that the steak and potatoes together was first, and later on people broke them up. One manuscript said steak, the other manuscript said potatoes. You see, and that's exactly what happened. The longer text is the text that underlies our King James Bible. The longer text is the traditional text. The longer text is the Textus Receptus. And what these false iconoclasts and these false prophets and these false theologians, the Gnostics, what they did was to chop out this word, chop out that word, chop out this word, shorten the thing up from the longer version. They didn't take this plus this and that equals something else. Because the reason is, the longer version has the tremendous number of witnesses. The longer version, meat and potatoes, has 5,210 instances that's the way it was. The longer version. And every one of those manuscripts that has that particular book and that particular phrase, if that's the phrase, this is just an illustration, every one of them has it identically. Meat and potatoes. But if you take the position that meat was first and potatoes is first, separately, how can you combine meat and potatoes both together equally in so many common manuscripts as we have 5,210 that go along with the traditional text manuscripts? You just can't put those 2 together and then multiply them all over the then known world and have them come out, meat and potatoes, exactly in the same order that you have. This is the argument that I would like to make against this irony. That's, who's to say, if you only have the 8 instances, from internal evidence alone, who can dogmatically say which is posterior, that is, afterward, the entire text, or the respective portions of it? Let me continue. Miller says, surely, the integral whole, which Dr. Hort, page 134 of his introduction, admits to possess, quote, lucidity and completeness. Notice, the integral whole, he says, he admits, it possesses lucidity, that is, clarity and completeness, and to be, quote, entirely blameless on either literary or religious grounds as regards vulgarized or unworthy diction. End of quote. That's what Hort says. Who said that has the better title to be held to have been the original form than any of the separate portions? Now, let me just simply say, you have the larger reading that even Hort admits is lucid, it's complete, it's brainless as to integrity and documentation, literary quality, it's blameless regarding religious grounds, it's not vulgarized, doesn't have any unworthy diction or phraseology. Who's to say that that longer portion, the Textus Receptus reading, the traditional text reading, was not first? And then these others, A, B, and Aleph, sliced off this word, sliced off that word. My friend, do you realize that the text that underlies these perversions of the day, NIV, NASV, Living Version, New English Version, and all the rest of them, Bradman, Holdman, and so on, do you realize that that B and Aleph text, Westcott and Hort type of text, is 2,886 Greek words shorter than the text that underlies our King James Bible? Do you realize that? Dr. Jack Mormon again, by actual word count from the Nassau text versus the text that underlies our King James Bible. Notice, 2,886 Greek words shorter than the text that underlies our King James Bible, the Textus Receptus. That's the text. 2,886 Greek words shorter that these new perversions are based on. No wonder there's doctrinal perversion and perverseness. No wonder when you take out 2,886 Greek words, drop them right out of your text, doctrine is going to be involved, and it is involved, and it was involved to the tune of 356 doctrinal passages. And don't tell me that it was accidental. Only accidental. If it's only accidental, then why does the final portion, the final statement, the final paragraph, the final sentence structure, why is it intact? If it were accidental, it would be nonsense. You'd drop your eye from one line to the other line and you'd make nonsense. Why is there not nonsense in it? Why is it clear? Why is it smooth? The B and Aleph renderings, why is it smooth? Because the heretics made it smooth. The heretics knew which of the 2,886 Greek words to drop out in order to make their heresies acceptable to the churches. The Gnostic heresies are just that, heresies. And if they could get a manuscript in their hands, as I believe they did with B and Aleph, Vatican and Sinai, and they could doctor that manuscript, they could knock it apart, they could change it, they could add false doctrine, take away true doctrine, and make it their own, then you have what you find in B and Aleph, Vatican and Sinai today. Again, which form the very bedrock foundation of the modern versions of our day. Shame on these so-called scholars who make us to worship B and Aleph. These Gnostic manuscripts, these Gnostic heretical manuscripts that are 2,886 Greek words shorter than our Textus Receptus, that have 356 doctrinal errors in them, and that actually have 8,000 differences. By actual count of Dr. Jack Mormon, over 500 large pages giving the evidence of it. Over 8,000 differences in their text and ours. I tell you, my friend, this is serious business. Let me continue. On page 53, Miller says this. Omission must be a possible fault with all copyists, and indubitable instances show that the scribes of Aleph and B, that is, the Sinai and Vatican, were habitual offenders in this respect. Let me pause right here. Aleph and B, B and Aleph, Vatican and Sinai, were habitual offenders in this respect of omission. That is, dropping out letters, dropping out words. That's why you have a text that is 2,886 Greek words shorter than the King James Bible's received Textus Receptus. They were habitual offenders. Drop this out. Drop that out. Take this away. And they continue. With reference to the character of the texts, many scholars would not agree with Drs. Westcott and Hort in the value which they set upon it. upon a Thucydian ruggedness. Thucydian ruggedness. Let me continue. Point number two on this breakdown. And Miller says this. As to the alleged absence of readings of the traditional text from the writings of the Anti-Nicene Fathers. Now, they try to say that there are very few readings of the traditional text from the Anti-Nicene. Now, Nicene, Council of Nicaea was 325 A.D. Anti-Nicene would be before 325 A.D. He says we don't have any readings. That's what the Westcott North people are saying. That's what the people are, that espouse that view today are saying. Now, Dr. Hort draws largely upon his imagination and his wishes. Now, this is important. I don't know how many places I've read in the literature these days of our, even of our fellow fundamentalists who take the position that the Westcott and Hort critical text is superior to the text Receptus. Any number of times, I've read in their articles that there are no traditional readings of any kind prior to 400 or 500 A.D. Nothing in 100 A.D. Nothing in 200 A.D. Nothing in 300 A.D. Nothing up to even a 400 A.D. Now, that simply is dead wrong. I don't know when these intellectual giants, as they try to pose themselves as, will come to the realization that this is a false statement. Yet, it's made repeatedly. D.A. Carson in his book, and others, Samuel Schneider in his recent book, all these different men have said the same thing. There are no traditional text Receptus readings prior to a certain time in church history, 500, 400, 300, whatever, Anti-Nicene Fathers. Well, if that be the case, pray tell me this. How could Dean Burgon, writing in 1886, 1884, 1885, with all of his staff, looking at the quotations of the early church fathers, for example, looking at 75 or 76 of the early church fathers that died 400 A.D. or before. Now, that's the cutoff time of these church fathers. 400 A.D. or before, how could Dean Burgon and his staff come up with quotation after quotation after quotation from those early 76 church fathers of the traditional text if it were not in existence at the time? How could he do it? How could they do it? In fact of the matter is, not only is it a falsehood and a big fat lie, if you want to be honest about it, for those so-called scholars who don't know what they're talking about in this area and are actually nitwits in this particular field, how can they continue to say no traditional text readings prior to 400 A.D.? Now, friend, if the people that died 400 A.D. and before, 76 of them, church fathers, how can you find quotation after quotation? Not only are they there, but they are there, the quotations, in a majority of cases. Not a simple majority, but a majority of 3-2, as Dean Burgon has shown. 3-2 in favor of readings and words from the Textus Receptus traditional text, those kind of texts and readings that underlie our King James Bible. Now, 3-2 advantage means 60% to 40%, doesn't it? 60% to 40% in favor of traditional readings prior. Now, this is what these Westcott and Hort people are lying to you about. I just put it right out there. They're absolutely lying. And for Samuel Schneider or anyone else who's writing books, or whether it's Dr. Custer, whoever it may be from Bobdingnag University, whether it's somebody from Central Baptist Seminary, Calvary Baptist Seminary in Lansdale, Pennsylvania, whether it's Detroit Baptist Seminary, whether it's Maranatha Baptist Bible College, whoever you might see or hear or read who might tell you that there are no traditional text readings prior to 500 or 450 A.D. is just plain telling you a falsehood. They're telling you a lie. I'm not calling them liars. I'm saying they're telling you, in that instance, a falsehood and a drastic lie. And it's a lie that is a horrendous, horrendous, serious lie and error indeed. Now, Dean Vergon and his staff made this study in 1885-86, along in there, but not to take that as the only idea and the only study. Dr. Jack Mormon, one of our leading scholars in the area of textual criticism from the Texas Receptus side of the fence, he's one of our missionaries, Bible for Today Baptist Church missionary there in London, England. We have published, our Bible for Today ministry has published some 5 or 6 books by Dr. Jack Mormon, many of them excellent textual books, Forever Settled, we put in hardback edition, in fact. Other ones are in copy machine format, but they're very good books. Not to be undone by the textual critics that say that there are no traditional readings prior to 400 or so A.D., he made a study of the Ante-Nicene fathers, the fathers, the church fathers, and leaders of the church that lived prior to the Council of Nicaea 325 A.D., Ante-Nicene fathers. His conclusion was even better than Dean Burgon's. Dean Burgon said, yes, there are quotations from the traditional text, the text Receptus, prior to 400 A.D. Yes, 76 church fathers studied, looked at, examined in a ratio, not simply that they're there, but a majority, not simple majority, but 3-2 majority, 60-40% majority. Well, what did Dr. Jack Mormon find? He looked at the Ante-Nicene fathers and he found that not 60% to 40%, but 70% to 30% of the quotations that were made by the early church fathers prior to 400 A.D. were Texas Receptus traditional text quotations and readings. And for Dan Wallace from Dallas Seminary, where I graduated with my Doctor of Theology degree, to say that there's no early attestation of traditional text readings prior to 400 A.D., dead wrong. It is a falsehood of the greatest magnitude to say this. And this is what is being said repeatedly. I mean book after book, speaker after speaker, tape recording after tape recording. I'm not exaggerating. I'm angry about this thing because it's false. And they're telling untruths. And my Bible quotes John 8:44, the Lord Jesus Christ talking to the disciples of paganism and disciples of the Pharisees. And he said to them, I'm not talking to my fellow fundamentalists now when I'm quoting this verse. Lord Jesus was quoting it of unbelievers. But there's some evidence and truth in that quotation I want you to listen to. He said to the Pharisees, unbelievers, I'm not saying this to our fellow believer fundamentalists, don't get me wrong and don't quote me wrong. Don't you dare do that. I'm simply saying the Lord Jesus said, he pointed his finger right at those Pharisees and said, ye are of your father the devil, and the lusts of your father ye will do. He was a murderer from the beginning and abode not in the truth, for there's no truth in him. When he speaketh a lie, he speaketh of his own, for he is a liar and the father of it. Unquote, John 8:44. Our Bible for Today Baptist Church has memorized that verse along with 25 or 30 others in our afternoon Bible study, 1:30 every Sunday. That's our evening service time. But that verse says that the father of the lie is the devil. Now, do you mean to tell me that Bible-believing fundamentalist Christians can lie? By all means, they can lie. And they do lie. And when fundamentalists say that there are no traditional text readings prior to 400 A.D. in all the church fathers, that is a lie. And the Lord Jesus said, the father of lies is the devil. And Christians, Bible-believing Christians, should have no business dealing with lies. And I'd like every single person that's written this lie. Fundamentalist people listening to my voice, maybe those that aren't listening to my voice, people will tell them and ask them about it. I want you to call me up at 1-800-JOHN-10-9 and tell me that you're going to get the traditional text of the Holy Gospels by Dean John William Burgon and Edward Miller, and you're going to see and examine for yourself the 76 church fathers and the number of quotations of the traditional text prior to 400 A.D. when they all died. And then I want you to tell me this. I'm going to buy the book by Dr. Jack Mormon where he examines the early church fathers, and he gets a 70% to 30% in favor of the traditional text prior to 400 A.D. And I want you to tell me you're going to buy that book and you're going to read it. And then, my friends, some of you who are teaching this falsehood, teaching this lie, that there's no traditional text prior to 400 A.D. or 300, 500, whatever, I want you men that are teaching this falsehood, teachers, fundamentalist teachers, whatever you may be, to call me up and tell me you're changing your views and you're now going to behold that there are quotations of the traditional text prior to 400 A.D., and you're no longer to hold this nonsense, this falsehood, and this lie. My, I'd love to have hundreds of the people call me up, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. You don't even have to pay a nickel. And tell me you're going to look into this subject and to see the falseness. You see, they've got to prove that their text, being our text, is primary, and that the text receptus is secondary. They must try to prove that their text was first and our text was second. That, my friend, is false. Totally, deliberately, lying, false. And it's a falsehood for any man, no matter what his status, whether fundamentalist, liberal, new evangelical, or whatever. It's fundamentally false for him to say that there are no traditional text receptus readings in the churches, in the documents of the early church fathers who died 400 A.D. and before. That is falsehood upon falsehood. Now, quote me right if you're going to quote me. I've called no fundamentalist a liar. I've simply said that if a fundamentalist tells a lie, he's telling a falsehood. He's telling that which is not true. And this is where the rubber meets the road. Time's up for now. Remember the words of our Lord Jesus Christ in John 10:9. He said, I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved and shall go in and out and find pasture. Write us. Bible for Today, Collingswood, New Jersey. Or call us on the order phone, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Ask your bookstore for Defending the King James Bible and the Defined King James Bible. Or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. We'll tell you how to get them. Dr. D.A. Waite, signing off and reminding you, you're going to have confidence in the King James Bible because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. We're going to continue this broadcast, my friend. We're going to continue this extreme textualism, the theories of Westcott and Hort, refuted by Edward Miller, this guide to the textual criticism of the New Testament. I want you to get a copy of it. You should get it. 350 pages, very brief, very important, hardback edition. And we're going to continue to exalt our Textus Receptus that underlies our King James Bible and our King James Bible, which God has given to us. Pray for us. Until next broadcast, same time, same station. So long. We now present the Bible for Today of the Air, heard each week at the same time and over the same station, sponsored by the Bible for Today Incorporated and the Dean Burgon Society, with international studios at 900 Park Avenue, Collingswood, New Jersey. This is Dr. D.A. Waite, director of the Bible for Today, speaking. Welcome to weekly broadcast number 851. 851 weeks of weekly broadcasting, standing together with the Dean Burgon Society in defense of traditional Bible texts, including the traditional Masoretic Hebrew Old Testament text, the traditional received Greek New Testament text, and the traditional English text, the King James Bible. We're building Bible confidence. Confidence in the King James Bible because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. The order phone number is 1-800-JOHN-10-9. For other things, please call us on a question and answer phone, 856-854-4452, or email bft@biblefortoday.org. We'd like to hear from you. We'd like to get our book called Defending the King James Bible. Now in its 8th printing, 350 pages, hardback edition, why not ask your bookstore to get Defending the King James Bible, or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Then have you ordered your Defined King James Bible, which is given and published by the Bible for Today? Uncommon words in the King James are defined accurately in the footnotes. It's deluxe, genuine leather, not another Bible in the world like it. Choice of 12-point large print or 10-point medium print, 46,000 are in print and distributed worldwide. Why not order yourself a copy for yourself and your friends, the Defined King James Bible? Call us, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. We'll tell you how to get it. All right, we're continuing in this Guide to the Textual Criticism of the New Testament by Edward Miller, an associate of Dean John William Burgon. I'm reading from a 150-page book recently reprinted, hardback edition, by the Dean Burgon Society, of which I've been president now for 25 years. It's an excellent book. You ought to get it. Written by Edward Miller back in 1885, 1886, but still very pertinent because it goes in to the false extreme textualism of Westcott and Hort. And certainly we have some Westcott and Hort people even yet today, 100-plus years afterwards. We're on page number 53. Hope you'll get a copy of the book. Number two in this chapter, talk about extreme textualism. He talks about the alleged traditional texts from the writings of anti-Nicene fathers, those fathers that died 400 AD or before, or actually 325, which was the Council of Nicaea. Dr. Hort, Miller says, draws largely upon his imagination and his wishes. Let me continue now. Miller says this, the persecution of Diocletian is here also the parent of much want of information. Unquote. Let me pause right there. Diocletian and other emperors, when they destroyed the Christians, burning them and grievously torturing them at the stake in other ways, they not only burned the Christians, but they burned their Bibles. And they took away much of the evidence in the early Bibles. They were the Bibles that they were using. They were not using the Westcott and Hort type of B and Aleph text, that terrible monstrosity from Egypt, on which is the basis, of all the modern versions of our day. New International Version, today's New International Version, today's English Version, NASB, and so on. They did not use those. They were using the received Textus Receptus traditional text, and many of them were burned during the persecution of Diocletian, the emperor of Rome. So that's why there's a want or lack of much information. Let me continue. Miller says, but is there really such a dearth of these readings in the works of the early fathers as is supposed? End of quote. Now, last broadcast, I railed out against strongly those people who are inventors of lies and falsehoods concerning the fact, saying, well, there's no traditional text receptus reading prior to 400 AD or 500 AD, and I said that's false. And so Miller is asking the question, is there really such a dearth of these readings in the works of the early fathers, these early church leaders, as is supposed? Then he quotes Dr. Frederick Scribner. He says, quote, Dr. Scribner maintains that Dr. Hort speaks much too sweepingly. Besides this, Dean Burgon has cited against the readings advocated by the new school more than 50 authorities from anti-Nicene writings upon five passages. And notice, these authorities on these five passages, the passages are the last four verses of Mark, 1 Timothy 3:16, Luke 22:43-44, Luke 23:34, Luke 2:14. And it says the number of early fathers, ending always with Eusebius, is about 100. That's from Burgon's last 12 verses of Mark, page 21. We've reprinted that in the Dean Burgon Society. You can get it if you wish. The Revision Revised, page 290. And chapter 6 to the end. And then he says, Dean Burgon's command of patristic evidence, the church fathers evidence, is simply marvelous. It is to be hoped that he will communicate to the church the treasures that he must have been long amassing. And of course, that's a footnote here from Miller's book. Well, Dean Burgon has printed posthumously through Edward Miller's help in the traditional text. He's reprinted the documentation, the evidence of these church fathers' quotations that died, these church fathers, 76 of them, that died 400 A.D. or before. They're replete, I say, with quotations from the traditional type text. In a ratio, in fact, of 3-2 in favor of the traditional text versus the Neologian text, as he calls it, or the Westcott and Ord B. and Aleph type of text. That's 60% to 40%. As we mentioned last broadcast, Dr. Jack Mormon, an excellent scholar from London, England, has given a report on the early church fathers, and his ratings are even higher than Dean Burgon's. Instead of 60% to 40%, it's 70% to 30% in favor of these early quotations of the traditional text or Textus Receptus. Let me continue. Edward Miller says this. Are these 10 testimonies, on an average, to each passage to be reckoned an alien to the traditional text, or not rather as evident indications of an earlier origin reaching back to the apostolic age? End of quote. Can I just comment briefly on that? How did these traditional text readings get in these passages, these 10 testimonies? These passages of Scripture, over 100 different testimonies as to the quotations of the traditional type text. How did they get there? This is an evidence, my friends, of an earlier origin of the traditional text, reaching back to the apostolic age. These church fathers, these early church leaders, have dates. We know when they lived. We know when they died. And these dated evidences, these patristic quotations, these early church fathers, show that they had a working knowledge of the traditional text. Not the polluted text of B and Aleph, the Vatican and Sinai text, but the traditional text. Because they quoted from the traditional text when it came to Mark 16, 9-20, the last 12 verses of Mark. They quoted from the traditional text when it came to 1 Timothy 3:16, God manifest in the flesh. B and Aleph don't have God manifest in the flesh. He appeared in the body or something else, not God, not Theos, but Hos or Ha, either who or which, as a relative pronoun. They quote from Luke 22:43-44, traditional text readings. They quote from Luke 23:34, traditional text readings. From Luke 2:14, traditional text readings. Now, how do they get the traditional text readings if the traditional text was not in existence when they wrote? In the early years, 150 A.D., 125, 200 A.D., 250, and so on, they had that in their hands. This proves, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the traditional text, the Textus Receptus underlying our King James Bible, was first, and the false text of B and Aleph was an aberration of it, and is second. It's after the traditional text. And the people that are aping the theories of Westcott and Hort, including our present-day fundamentalist schools, such as Bob Jones University, Detroit Baptist Seminary, Calvary Baptist Seminary, and Central Seminary, Maranatha Baptist Bible College, Northland Bible College, these schools, fundamental schools as they are aping the falsehoods of Westcott and Hort by saying, and admittingly, wrongfully saying, that the Westcott and Hort false B and Aleph text preceded the Textus Receptus. No, my friends. The Textus Receptus traditional text preceded and predated the false B and Aleph text underlying the new versions of our day, namely Westcott and Hort's text, or the Nestle-Aland text, and those texts are there. So this is what Edward Miller is saying. All right, let me continue. Besides the fathers, some of the versions, notably the Peshitta, which is referred by the best critics to the second century, that are older than any manuscripts, give frequent support to the readings of the traditional text. Now, end of quote. Let me pause right there. Edward Miller says, beside the church fathers. In other words, so you have manuscripts that may be more recent that have the traditional text, text receptus type of things on them. Many of them even more recent. But there are manuscripts that go and documents that go before and in front of any manuscript, namely the church fathers or the early church versions. And the Peshitta version, which is referred by the best critics to the second century. That's 150 A.D. And this is important. In fact, Edward Miller, chapter 6, takes a whole chapter to talk about the dates of the Peshitta Syriac and proving to me, as other people, I'm sure, if they listen to it, proving that the Peshitta is 150 A.D. or thereabouts, second century. And the Peshitta is almost the same as the traditional text or the text of Receptus. And so we have the notability and the earliness of not only the Church Fathers' quotations of the traditional text, but also the versions, notably the Peshitta, that are older than any manuscripts, and they give frequent support to the readings of the traditional text. Well, there's a third point in answer now to the Westcott and Hort falseness. Miller says this: what is said about internal evidence is much too vague and misty to sustain so strong a conclusion, and it is balanced with a candid admission that, after all, the peculiar readings of the received text may perhaps be derived from some equally ancient and perhaps purer text now otherwise lost. End of quote. Let me pause right there. So what he's saying is that it should be balanced out by the admission that the peculiar readings of the received text may perhaps be derived from some equally ancient and perhaps purer text than the Westcott and Hort type of text. Now that's what Westcott and Hort, their introduction on page 115, admit. They even agree with this, that this is a possible situation. Let me continue. Miller says, what seems to Dr. Westcott and Dr. Hort to constitute internal evidence in each instance does not seem so to others. Where is the rock amidst this pestilent sand drift? Where is the rock amidst this pestilent, or perilous rather, sand drift? In other words, they're looking for the rock, something stable. And the internal evidence of Drs. Westcott and Hort are not what other people consider to be internal evidence at all. Miller continues, we are driven, therefore, to the characters of Aleph and B, the Sinai and the Vatican manuscripts, as the last refuge of the theory under examination. You see, end quote, Edward Miller is examining the false theory of the extreme textualists Westcott and Hort. And what about the quality? What about the characters? And he continues, and we cannot but be struck with the great argument in their favor. They are the oldest manuscripts in existence. They are extremely handsome, and in some respects are complete. Of course, there's a footnote on that as far as complete. Aleph is the only complete unsealed copy of the New Testament. B ends at Hebrews 2:14, but is complete so far, except in its numerous omissions. So they're fairly complete. He's giving some of the good points of B and Aleph. Their verdict, in the opinion of nearly all judges, and nearly all judges, is entitled to respectful attention. Their verdict. Now that's so much for the good qualities of B and Aleph, Vatican and Sinai, that are worshipped by Bishop Westcott and Professor Hort. But then he goes on to say this. Miller says, but besides that, they are not much older than A and C. Manuscripts A and C, in other words, the two other uncials. How can Drs. Westcott and Hort get over the central fact that these manuscripts have hardly any following in the ages after them, and so have been condemned by Catholic antiquity? End of quote. Let me pause right there. Catholic antiquity, meaning universal antiquity, not Roman Catholic antiquity. We must be understood as far as the use of Catholic here, katholos, Greek term katholos, according to all. That means katholos, Catholic or universal antiquity. Let me read that sentence once again. This is crucial. How can Westcott and Hort say, get over the central fact that these manuscripts, that is, B and Aleph, have hardly any following in the ages after them, and so have been condemned by Catholic or universal antiquity. What he's getting at is this. B and Aleph have not been copied and recopied by the ages following them. They have been disbarred. They have been disbanded. They have been absolutely ridiculously left aside. They have been cast aside. They have not been copied and recopied such as the traditional text of Receptus has been copied and recopied. They have been abandoned by the generations and ages after them, following them. And therefore, says Miller, have been condemned by Catholic or universal antiquity. That's an important point. One of the seven traits that Dean Burgon had to evidence as far as what the reading should be, one of the seven things is continuity. Does this reading, does this Greek word have continuity? Can it be traced back to the apostolic age? The 100s, the 200s, the 300s, the 400s, AD, 500, 600, 700, 800, the 1000. Is there continuity? And the answer for continuity of B and Aleph, these false Gnostic texts, the age of continuity, has to be said, no, they have no continuity. After 400 AD or so, they stopped copying them because they realized the church, the Catholic antiquity, universal antiquity, realized them to be false and perverted. They laid them aside. The only reason they're preserved, do you know why B and Aleph are preserved to this day? Because of disuse, number one, and because of climate, number two. They were Egyptian, the climate was conducive, and they were disused by the church, laid aside in some library, in some monastery, and not used, therefore preserved. Why weren't they used? Because the churches knew them to be false. That's why they weren't used. Why are they used today as the basis of the NIV, the NASV? Because those professors and teachers that are pushing these false manuscripts don't believe that they're false. They think the churches of antiquity, down through the corridors of time, were wrong. And they think that they're right. And they have dug up from the grave the bones of B and the bones of Aleph of the Vatican and Sinai manuscripts and resurrected them, put flesh upon them, and said, these are the true manuscripts. And they've thrown away the hearing and the wisdom of the churches in the past. And they've now taken a different tack. They've taken up where the heretics have left off. And that's why there are 356 heretical versions, or passages, in B and Aleph. And the 356 heretical passages also in the NIV, because they follow B and Aleph, Vatican and Sinai. 356 passages in the New American Standard Version, and the other versions that follow the false versions of B and of Aleph. Let me continue on page 55 now. Miller says this. They were probably produced, that is, B and Aleph, Vatican Sinai, that are worshipped by many of our fundamentalist brethren. They were probably produced about AD 330 to 340. Now, that's a possibility. a short time before the canon of Holy Scriptures was settled, when the general subject of the Holy Scriptures must have come under discussion. End of quote. Let's pause right there. This was shortly before the canon, that is, the exact books that should be in the Scripture, was settled. 330, maybe 340 A.D. But they were discussed. Let me continue. Miller says, they just antedated, that is, they just came before in date, these two manuscripts, B and Aleph, the most intelligent period of the early Church, when the finest intellects in the world were engaged in ascertaining the exact lineaments or alignments of the faith once delivered to the saints. End of quote. Let me pause right there. The scrutiny that these intellectual giants gave to the manuscripts when they decided on the canon, they also decided on the text of Scripture, we believe, as Dean Burgon has mentioned, the Council of Chalcedon, one of the Councils of Chalcedon, when they determined the canon of Scripture, they also determined the text of Scripture. And the churches determined that the traditional text, the Textus Receptus type of text that underlies our King James Bible, was the text to be preserved and the text to be followed. And this is what they did. And these men, in the finest intellects in the church, during the period of the most intelligent period of the early church, in 350, 375, and 360, and so on, in these times, they were ascertaining the exact lineaments or alignments of the faith once delivered unto the saints. Then Miller continues, how could these men, that is, these giants of intellect, these godly men of the churches, how could these men have escaped from spending particular care upon the sacred text? In other words, Miller says, they looked about the sacred text. They wondered about the care that was placed upon it. And they were interested in the words of Scripture. They continue. And Miller says, we learn that St. Jerome did so upon the Latin versions. And that he, in other words, he looked at the different words and the different the sacred text. And the fact acknowledged over and over again by Dr. Hort that one uniform text has prevailed from that period till now surely alone constitutes a decisive condemnation of this so-called neutral text. End of quote. Let's go back over the thoughts in that sentence. Dr. Hort himself acknowledged that over and over again that there has been one uniform text that has prevailed from that period, 350 AD, until now. And he does agree with that. Now, he tries to explain why that is the case. He explains it away with some recension, 250 AD, 350 AD, which has never been proved, which is proved to be false. But he does admit that there's a uniform text from 350 AD under the present one he was writing in 1881. A uniform text. He refers to that text as the similar to the traditional text. Uniform. That prevailed from 350 to the present time when he's writing, 1881. Uniformity and continuity of text that prevailed until that time. That means the Textus Receptus, that means the traditional text that Dean Burgon refers to, is the text that was uniform throughout all those years, 350 AD, 1800 AD, 1500 years of uniformity and conformity to the truth. And that should be, he says, Miller says, a decisive condemnation of the so-called neutral text, that is, B and Aleph, or Westcott and Hort's so-called neutral text. Miller continues. The period, too, of the production of these two manuscripts, that is, B and Aleph, is instructive. The period of the production. In other words, when were they produced? What is the period of time when the B and Aleph were produced? Continue. Let me say, Miller says this. It was when the church was all but semi-Arian. It was when the church was all but semi-Arian. Now, semi-Arianism, remember, Arianism denies the Trinity, denies the deity of the Lord Jesus Christ. Semi-Arianism makes a question as to his pure deity as well as pure humanity, and perfect humanity as well as his perfect deity. So semi-Arianism was a terrible, terrible faction of the church, and it was all but semi-Arian during that time, 330 to 340 A.D., when B and Aleph were concocted and were actually doctored and changed, where they changed the traditional text by dropping out this word, changing that word, and making it impure. Very important to see that what it was when the church was all but semi-Arian. Of this, there is no doubt. Semi-Arianism was there in the church, as Miller points out. It's a very important factor. Now, if semi-Arianism, that is, false doctrine after the deity of Christ, his bodily resurrection, his blood atonement, his virgin birth, all these things, when that was in the church, when the 340 to 330 AD or so, when B and Aleph were concocted and made up and were doctored from their traditional text, this is an important factor. That's why we see 350 doctrinal errors in the being out of text because of semi-Arianism that was prevalent and the Gnostic heretics that doctored that text to conform to their semi-Arianism and to their false doctrines in other areas. And they continue. Miller says, but it appears also extremely probable that they were made, that is, being out of Vatican Sinai manuscript were made under the direction of Eusebius of Caesarea, a leader of the Semi-Arian party. A leader of the Semi-Arian party. So under his direction, Eusebius called the shots for B and Aleph. Eusebius directed what should stay and what should go. Eusebius is the one that questioned and dropped out the entire last 12 verses of Mark. It's Eusebius that directed to take out the word God, theos, in 1 Timothy 3:16. God was manifest in the flesh. It was Eusebius that directed these various heretical places and passages to leave out, to change, because he was the leader of the Semi-Arian party and did not believe orthodoxy was the way to go. Let me continue. Miller says, the scribe of the Vatican B is supposed by Tichendorf, with the agreement of Dr. Scrivener and of the admission of Dr. Hort, to have written part of the Sinaitic Aleph. In other words, the scribe of Vatican B wrote part of the Sinaitic Aleph. Now that's agreed to in the plain introduction by Dr. Scrivener. It's agreed to also by Dr. Hort as well. Now this, the date of the execution as fixed upon other grounds was about the time when Eusebius was commissioned by Constantine to prepare 50 manuscripts of the Holy Scriptures and send them to Constantinople. End of quote. Let me pause right there. The date when the B and Aleph were made or executed, 330 to 340 AD, was approximately the same date when Eusebius was commissioned by the Emperor Constantine to prepare 50 manuscripts of the Holy Scriptures and send them to Constantinople. Same date, same time, same place. I'm going to stop right here. Time's up for now. Remember the words of our Lord Jesus Christ in John 10:9. He said, I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved and shall go in and out and find pasture. Write us. Bible for Today, Collingswood, New Jersey. Call us on the order line, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Ask your books over Defending the King James Bible and the Defined King James Bible, or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Dr. D.A. Waite signing off and reminding you to have confidence in the King James Bible, because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. All right, we're going to continue this next broadcast next week. We hope you can stay tuned. We're going to continue the Extreme Textualism Critique by Edward Miller. It's a theory of Westcott and Hort that is rebuked, that is refuted, and that has done a good job. This Westcott and Hort type of text, this B and Aleph text, is the antithesis in many places of our Textus Receptus that underlies our King James Bible. It's important to you who stand with us for the King James Bible and the Textus Receptus that underlies it and the Masoretic Hebrew text, very important that you get this book, The Textual Criticism Guide by Miller, and that you read it, that you study it. We hope that you'll stay tuned next time. Same station, same time, same broadcast. Until then, so long. We now present the Bible for Today of the Air, heard each week at the same time and over the same station, sponsored by the Bible for Today Incorporated and the Dean Burgon Society, with international studios at 900 Park Avenue, Collingswood, New Jersey. This is Dr. D.A. Waite, director of the Bible for Today, speaking. Welcome to weekly broadcast number 852. 852 weeks of weekly broadcasting, building Bible confidence. Confidence in the King James Bible, because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. The order phone number is 1-800-JOHN-10-9. For other things, please call us on a question and answer phone, 856-854-4452, or email bft@bibleforToday.org. We'd like to have you to get our book. We'd like to hear from you. Get our book, Defending the King James Bible. We'd like to have you order. It's 350 pages, rather, hardback edition, 8th printing. Hope that you can get it. Ask your bookstore for it or call us direct, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Then have you ordered your defined King James Bible, published for the Bible for today? Uncommon words in the King James are defined accurately in the footnotes. It's deluxe, genuine leather, so it's a 12-point large print, 10-point medium print, not another Bible in the world like it. 46,000 have been printed and distributed worldwide. Why not order yourself a copy and one for your friends? The defined King James Bible. Give us a call at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. We'll tell you how to get your copy for yourself. All right, we're continuing this week in this excellent book, A Guide to the Textual Criticism of the New Testament by Edward Miller, an associate of Dean John William Burgon. It's been reprinted by the Dean Burgon Society. Beautiful, 150-page, hardback edition, beautiful cover, yellow and red letters on it, binding. You ought to get it. Written by Edward Miller in about 1885, 1886, over 100 years old, but still very appropriate and very important as to diminishing and smashing and refuting the false theories of Bishop Westcott and Professor Hort. We're on page 55. If you have your book, want to follow along, we just read the thing and then we comment on these things. These are important because the battle is for our Bible today. The battle is for our Greek text that underlies our Scripture in the New Testament, the Hebrew text in the Old. This is basically a New Testament battle on the Greek text that underlies it, and it should not be the B and Aleph text that underlies the NIV, that underlies the New American Standard Version and other versions of our day. It should be the received text, the text receptus that underlies our King James Bible. All right, he's going into the history and the quality and the character of B and Aleph, the Vatican and Sinai manuscripts. Miller says this: these two manuscripts stand unrivaled for the beauty of their calligraphy. Now, let me pause right there. Calligraphy, kalos is beauty, and graphe to write. Beautiful writing, beautiful penmanship, beautiful calligraphy, and of the vellum on which they are written. In other words, the skin and beautiful letters. And in all respects are just what we should expect to have been produced in obedience to an imperial man, imperial mandate. And of course, that's what he believed. He's just mentioned that the imperial mandate of the Emperor Constantine has told Eusebius of Caesarea to produce these manuscripts, 50 copies, and bring them or send them or take them to Constantinople. And so the beauty of it, the calligraphy of it, the vellum, the skins, all the respects are equal to the command of the emperor. And that's exactly what the emperor did. And so this seems to be, these two seem to be one of the or two of the 50 that was commanded by Constantine to prepare by Eusebius and bring to Constantinople, the capital at that time. Let me continue on page 56. And as has been already stated, the text of these two manuscripts, that is, B and Aleph, the Vatican and Sinai, is not so perfect as would be necessary if they were worthy to be placed upon the high pedestal that is prepared for them by their ardent advocates. End quote. Let me just pause right there. The text of these two manuscripts, B and Aleph, is not so perfect as would be necessary if they were worthy to be placed upon the high pedestal that is prepared for them by their ardent advocates. My friends, the textual aberrations, the textual imperfections, the textual errors, the textual doctrinal perturbations and wrongnesses, 356 to be exact, by Dr. Jack Mormon, as he's mentioned, these things do not put the B and Aleph manuscripts on such a high pedestal as the ardent, fiery advocates have placed them. No, my friend. B and Aleph should be on a low pedestal. B and Aleph should be at the bottom of the barrel. They're not to be reckoned with at all, as to being high at all. Then he continues. Miller says, Dean Burgon, after collations extending through many years, by the way, collations mean comparing word by word different manuscripts, extending through many years, has supplied figures which it seems impossible to withstand. And he gives some of the figures in Revision Revised, for example, different pages. And figures collecting of these old 5-ounce unctuals showing that they're not what they're cracked up to be. They're not accurate, is what he's saying. Let me continue. The marks of carelessness spread over them, that is, over the B and Aleph manuscripts, the Vatican Sinai, which are the very basis of the Nestle-Aland Greek text, the basis of the United Bible Society Greek text, the basis of the Westcott and Hort text. The marks of carelessness spread over them, especially prevailing in Aleph or Sinai, are incompatible with perfection. Let me read that again. He's saying here that the imperfections that are there certainly do not necessitate putting them on a high pedestal as they have been placed before. The imperfections are clear. The imperfections are right there. There's no question about it. He says that the carelessness spread over them, especially in Aleph, are incompatible with perfection. Yet they're worshipped almost by those that worship B and Aleph in perfection. He mentions Tischendorf, after collating B, that is the Vatican, speaks of the blemishes that occur throughout. Dr. Dobbin reckons 2,556 omissions in B, the Vatican, as far as Hebrews 9:14, because it stops at Hebrews 9:14. Now, notice, that's where it terminates. Remember, Dr. Jack Mormon has listed, comparing Nestle-Aland text with the text receptus that underlies the King James Bible, he's listed 2,886 Greek words shorter in the Westcott and Hort B and Aleph Nestle-Aland text than the text receptus that underlies the King James Bible. And he's got in the up to Hebrews 9:14. Dobbin reckons 2,556 omissions, and Dr. Mormon, 2,886 Greek words shorter in the entire New Testament, which would be about the same as this man has found up through Hebrews 9:14. All the rest of Hebrews and all the rest of James, 1 Peter, 2 Peter, and so on, lists other omissions. And there's another man, Verselon. The editor tells of perpetual omissions of half a verse, a whole verse, and even several verses. So these are the omissions of Vatican Manuscript B. This is just what examination reveals. And Aleph, that is the Sinai, is unquestionably worse. So at least he says that Aleph, the Sinai, is worse than B, the Vatican. Let me continue. Yet doubtless, in the temperate words of Dr. Scrivener, quote, we accord to Codex B at least as much weight as to any document in existence, end of quote. Miller says this, but we cannot agree with those who rate either it or the Sinaitic manuscript, either B or Aleph, extravagantly high. We can't agree with those that rate it extravagantly high. And the fact that these two are frequently found with a few others in a small minority must make it always must make us always examine their testimony, unless it is strongly supported, with suspicion and care. Suspicion and care. Well, then, there's a footnote here on the character of B, the Vatican. Don't know whether I read all of it, but let's just go through a little bit of it on page 57. Judged by the ordinary rules of criticism, the text of B, the Vatican, is far from being of such a superior character as to warrant the excessive submission that extreme textualists claim for it. Let me just point that out. It's not a superior character. It does not warrant the excessive submission that extreme textualists claim for it. Yet Westcott and Hort said that B is the be-all and end-all of things. And extreme textualists, such as they were, says it's superior in all ways. Thus, besides serious blemishes, which have been already mentioned above, Miller says, we find in the face of superior readings, well attested, then he lists some things. Now, he lists things in the face of superior readings, well attested. Number one, omissions of entire verse or a longer passage, having all the appearance of being intrinsically genuine. He lists some of the passages that are involved in that. And number two, similar omissions of more than three words, and an inch and a half of documentation is here, giving the number of words that are lost and omitted. Number three, short but important omissions. He lists probably 2 inches of, maybe 2.5 inches of documents there, around page 57. Number four, readings inferior to those of the traditional text. And he lists a number of those as well. In fact, a whole page and a half of those readings that are inferior indeed. The list could be increased largely, he says. But then Miller says this: the arguments therefore advanced by the school of extreme, or as perhaps it should be called, extravagant textualism, break down all along the line, and we are driven to seek a secure position amongst the entrenchments of the rival school. So much for chapter 4. Let's move on to chapter 5 now, the rival school. The tenets of the rival and sound school stated and considered. This is the rival school, meaning the one that's opposed to the traditional text, such as the Westcott and Hort school, would be a rival school. He says, in treating of extreme textualism, so much has been borrowed from the representations of the rival school, which of late years has perhaps been chiefly known in resistance to aggressive tenets, that much less explanation of the principles maintained in it is now needful than would otherwise have been required. In other words, what he's saying is, we've talked about the rival school and the extreme textualism. We don't have to spend too much more time on it. That's what he's saying. Nevertheless, the opinion or position of the chief doctors of this school must be defined. Their attitude has been frequently and indeed strangely misrepresented. It is given not merely in opposition or protest, but in clear and definite expression of principles. Then he lists a number of paragraphs in this rival school compared to the sound school. Number one, and first it must be remarked that it is unjust to insinuate that they are set against all revision of the Greek text. They would not be textualists at all if they were not ready to adopt what are really the verdict upon all evidence. Now, what he's saying now, apparently, he's talking about now the school that he calls the sound school, not the rival school, and he says we've got to abide for it by all evidence. He says again and again, says Dean Burgon, we shall have to point out that the Textus Receptus needs correction. And let's stop right there. Dean Burgon said, yes, in minor points he feels, or he felt, back in 1888, he died, 1885, 86, long in there, he felt that it needed correction in minor points. But throughout the whole book, the Revision Revised, for example, he lists specifics as to how to revise it, the steps that must be taken to ensure its purity of revision. And I've written an entire book on this. When would Dean Burgon revise? When would Dean Burgon revise the Textus Receptus and the King James Bible? That's available if you're interested in it. Let us know. We'll see that you get it. When would Dean Burgon revise? You can write us, Bible for Today, Collingswood, New Jersey, or you can ask for it on the by the telephone, 1-800, toll-free call, 1-800. John 10:9. Ask for the booklet, when would Dean Burgon revise? If and when he had such stringent rules for revision, major revision of the Textus Receptus, that he could not meet in his day, and we by no means can meet in our day. And so the conclusion of the Dean Burgon Society and the conclusion of the Bible for Today ministry and my own conclusion is, leave it alone. Let it stand as it is until such a time as all the requirements of Dean Burgon have been met, and met fully. Leave it alone. And so we just leave the Textus Receptus that underlies our King James Bible alone, and we believe that's the text that should be. Now, continuing Miller. No one can read Dr. Scribner's plain introduction, a work which every clergyman should possess and study, without observing that so stiff an adhesion to the text received from the last three centuries has no place in his thoughts. Quotation or proof of so notorious a circumstance are absolutely unnecessary. In other words, also, Dr. Scribner doesn't believe that that the text receptors needs no reformation or changes in the minor ways, but Dean Bergen again has stated the specific ways in which the revision should be made, not hastily, but very carefully, if it does be required or to be revised later on. Miller continues, nor again must it be imagined that discretion in the employment of authorities is repeated, that is the subtle. As Dr. Scrivener rejects the idea of families of manuscripts, he allows that grouping in a moderate manner is necessary in order to judge of their character and value. Here's a quotation from Scrivener, quote, none of the theories about the formal recensions of whole clauses, whole classes rather, of these documents have generally been given up as purely visionary, and the very word families has come into disrepute by reason of the exploded fancies it recalls, we can discern, not the less clearly, that certain groups of them have in common not only a general resemblance in regard to the readings they exhibit, but characteristic peculiarities attaching themselves to each group. End of quote. That's a long sentence from Dr. Scribner. But he says they've got some similarities. Let me continue. Miller says, it is inevitable that one document should have a high reputation and another be rated deservedly low. The relative antiquity, now here's some of the circumstances that would rate whether a document should be accepted or not. The relative antiquity, the circumstances attending the production, so far as they're known, the nature of the text, so far as it reveals itself to clear and definite criticism, are admitted as demanding to be taken into account. Objection is felt to the glorification, now here's an objection, to the glorification of a few so as to make them almost, quote, objects of superstition and idolatry, end of quote. But there the objection ceases. In other words, we don't want to push these manuscripts like B and Aleph, glorifying them as objects of superstition and idolatry. And that's exactly what they've done with the B and Aleph manuscripts. Number two, a second thing. The leading principle of the school, I suppose he's still talking here now of the sound school, the leading principle is that all authority should be fairly and relatively weighed. End of quote. Let me pause right there. That's why Dean Bergen said, let's not hurriedly change even the small points of the text receptus that might need revision. Let's not hurriedly do this. They must be fairly weighed, all authorities. And they didn't have all the authorities to be weighed. It was not ready to be done. And Dean Bergen felt that the Westcott and Hort Greek text was hasty, should not be done. If he were living today, he would also agree, I'm sure, that the so-called majority text was hasty and should not have been done in that manner. Either the majority text of Hodgson and Farstad or the majority text of Robinson and Pierpont, either one. Let me continue. Miller says, the old Unschel manuscripts, according to their age and character, these are some of the things that must be weighed. The ancient Unschel manuscripts, according to their age and character, the old ones, the later Unschels of the 8th, 9th, and 10th centuries, the cursive, that is, flowing hand manuscripts from the 10th century onwards, the versions with reference to their antiquity and excellence, lectionized as they were accredited and agreed with one another and with other manuscripts, and quotations from fathers after their ascertained merit. Now, end of quote. Those are the things that must be undertaken and must be looked at in order to ascertain what the proper text should be. Let me continue. There's much work to be done in editing, collating, and indexing before this vast mass of evidence is ready for use. Now, Edward Miller is writing in 1885 and 1886. Dean Bergen died in 1888. Here, in this time frame, he says there's much work to be done in editing, collating, indexing, before this vast mass of evidence is ready for use. he's saying caution. Even though there may be a few odds and ends that need to be straightened out in the text for separates, there's got to be editing, collating, and indexing before this vast mass of evidence is ready for use. It's still not ready for use. It's still not, it's not been ascertained properly. And therefore, we should not rush to judgment. And if it's not ready for use, my principle is leave it alone. Stay with what we have in the text receptors that underlies our King James Bible. Let me continue. Thus, these men widen the basis and endeavor to build their superstructure upon the broadest and surest foundation, that is, the sound school. If it be objected that the work of revision is indeed formidable and must be delayed under this method of proceeding for many years, the answer is ready. Now, that idea of delayed for many years under this method of proceeding, and that's what Dean Burgon suggested in his own work, and if you're interested in getting it, when would Dean Burgon revise? Write for it. It's a book that I've written. I sum up the quotations from the Revision Revised, every place where Dean Burgon says we must revise the King James Bible's text, the text receptus, that is. He sums up all these things, and then we see in that summation, we see in that summation the particulars that Dean Burgon required before the revision of the text receptus could take place. And he says right here, Miller, it's formidable. And if it must be delayed for many years, the answer is ready. Delay it. And that's what should have been done in the so-called majority text. It should have been delayed. It should have been done for the Westcott and Hort text. It should have been delayed. The answer is ready. Then he says this, quote, very important. It is dangerous to meddle with the Holy Scriptures, which are bound up so closely with the faith. The changes proposed are numerous and momentous. And what if they are found to be really corruptions and deprivations of the sacred deposit? In other words, don't rush to judgment on this thing. Let me continue. Reverence and caution are essential in the things of God. Whatever is done must by all means be well done. A few years, or a lifetime, or two, long indeed in our sight, are little in the history of mankind. It's this one we have to do. You see, he's talking about years, lifetime or two. They don't have all the documentation. They don't have all the collations. They don't have all the things necessary that Dean Burgon said must be necessary prior to a major revision of the text of receptus in the small points in which he thinks it might be able to be revised. Again, I ask you, if you're interested in that book, when would Dean Burgon revise? When would Dean Burgon revise? Write for it. Bible for Today, Collingswood, New Jersey, or call us on the telephone, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. We'll tell you how to get it. We'll give it to you free and postpaid. I think it's about an $8 or $10 value, that booklet, on when would Dean Burgon revise. Let me continue. Reverence and caution are necessary. Now, here's what it says. It's better to aid humbly in a steady and wise advance than to attempt hastily to settle questions and to end up by unsettling them. Trying to settle them, then unsettling them. And that's why he says caution before a major revision, and Dean Burgon agrees with it. And let me continue. Point number three. Such is the general system of the school of sound or high textualists. This system of sound textualists. But in one grand point, the school is at least with the last. Extreme textualism seems to look upon any support derived from the traditional received texts as merely supplying to readings a title to be abused and spurned instead of securing for them consideration of respect. End of quote. Let me pause right here. Now, he's saying here that the school of extreme textualism looks upon any support derived from the traditional or received text. Now, by the way, he's identifying. Here, Miller is identifying traditional texts and received texts. That's what it means. Traditional means something that's received by handing it down from one to another. That's like the Masoretic text, the traditional text of Hebrew. He says, The extreme textualists seem to look upon any support derived from the traditional received text as merely supplying to readings a title to be abused and spurned instead of securing for them considerations of respect. My friend, this extreme textualism school frowns upon the traditional text readings, frowns upon the text of the Textus Receptus readings, and that's horribly wrong. Let me continue. Yet, the fact admitted several times by Drs. Westcott and Hort that the traditional text is 1,500 years old ought surely to ensure for it other treatment. End of quote. Did you understand what he's saying there? Hort and Westcott both agreed that the traditional text, that's our Textus Receptus that underlies our King James Bible, is 1,500 years old. Now, if it's 1,500 years old, that ought certainly, he says, to ensure some respect. That reading, that text should not be abused. That text should not be spurned, as it is in Mark 16:9-20, for example, just because B and Aleph omit the last four verses of Mark, and because 18 other uncials have it, because 600 cursors have it, because it's recognized in 19 of the early church fathers' quotations, just because it's in 10 early versions, documentation that's without question sound, they reject it, Mark 16:9-20, because B and Aleph have rejected it, and they look upon the manuscripts of the received text and traditional text as abused and spurned. My friend, brethren, this ought not so to be. We're going to stop right here. Time's up for now. Remember the words of our Lord Jesus Christ in John 10:9. He said, I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he should be saved, and shall go in and out and find pasture. Write us. Bible for Today, Collinswood, New Jersey. Or call us on the order phone, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Ask your bookstore for Defending the King James Bible and the Defined King James Bible, or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Well, we're going to continue on this thing. Dr. D.A. Waite signing off and reminding you, you can have confidence in the King James Bible because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. We're going to continue the sound school of the textual criticism and the rival school. We're going to continue this next broadcast. We hope you'll stay tuned. This is a very important subject. And we want you to get this guide to the textual criticism of the New Testament by Edward Miller, Associate Dean John William Burgon. It's 150 pages, hardback edition. Ask for how to get it by calling at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. It's a hardback edition reprinted by the Dean Burgon Society. This is essential because this takes into consideration the being out of school and the school that should not be used by us today. It's a school that should be knocked apart, a school that should be frowned upon, a school that should be knocked in, and that's what we seek to do. We stand for the King James Bible and the Greek text that underlies it. Hope to see you next broadcast, same time, same station. Until then, so long.